This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Episode 100 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. I knew for episode 100 that I was going to have to bring out the big guns. Unfortunately, I don't really know anybody with big guns, but I do know somebody with big puns. You know him, you love him. He is Luis Scott Vargas. Hello.
Hey, Erin, how's it going?
I am great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem. It sounds like a lot of fun. I know the other guys who I know who have gone on the show have enjoyed it.
I have had quite a few of them on my show, haven't I? And thank you so much for being patient with me through me being sick this past week. I really apologize for that.
Not an inconvenience at all.
Okay. In fact, the nicer you were about it, the more I felt. Have you ever had that happen before?
Yeah, I guess I understand what you're saying, but yeah. It really wasn't a problem.
Okay, cool. Because I was dreading it a little bit because I was like, oh my God, he's LSV. He's going to think I'm a moron and I'm unprofessional. And the nicer you were, I was like, I'm sorry, Luis. And people are like, he's cool with it. Don't beat yourself up. And it just turned into this vicious cycle. So thanks again for coming on the show. So I want to get started right away. August was a busy month for you. And part of the reason that we weren't able to record right away, I actually messaged you back in July and you had indicated that you were getting ready for the Pro Tour and that you were also going to be participating at GP Portland. And those were big moments for you and your team. Pro Tour Magic 2015, Owen, Huey, and Matt all made top eight. Reed, Huey, and Owen came in first at the GP, and then your team was not far behind. Then Chapin, who tested with Pantheon, wins Pro Tour Journey in the Knicks. This has been a big year for Team Pantheon and for you. What's the secret to this team's success? You guys are just taking over.
Well, I'm actually not on the Pantheon.
Did I get that wrong? Oh my gosh.
Well, I understand the confusion is that there's two Channel Fireball teams.
Okay.
So there's the Pantheon, which is all the guys you just named.
Okay.
There's also kind of the original team, Channel Fireball. These are the guys who've been together for a couple years now. The Pantheon has two, but they were called like Team Mythic before. They had a couple different names.
Okay.
But the team I'm on has like Josh Adelaide, Paulo Vitor Domodorosa, Eric Froelich, David Ochoa, Shahar Shenhar, Ben Stark, Shuai Nakamura. A lot of people you probably recognize as well.
Okay. But,
so, and Pat Cox, who did top eight the last Pro Tour.
Sure.
But we are two different teams.
Okay.
So, because, I mean, it's like 30 people put together. So it wouldn't actually work all that well to test in one team. And, you know, there's some amount of personality conflicts when you have a group that size with that many people who think a lot of different things.
Okay. So break it down for me because I didn't know this. And there might be people listening who don't know that. So the two of you, even though you're under the Channel Fireball umbrella, you do test separately. You do have separate leaders. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, nominally, I'm the leader of my team. I mean, but we try to be pretty democratic in our decisions. And when I actually interviewed John Finkel, he said pretty much the same thing. They just vote on everything in the Pantheon. So, yeah, there's two very separate groups when it comes to testing. We don't know what they're playing. They don't know what we're playing.
Really?
We prepare differently. Yeah, but the kind of we're all making content for the same website. So that's where the Channel Fireball part comes in.
Interesting. I had no idea that you guys didn't share information like that. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think it actually makes the Pro Tour more fun because we're competing against them. They're competing against us. I think that is more fun as someone who's going there and also as someone who's watching the Pro Tour. I mean, it's a more interesting storyline than like, you know, 30 people test together, have good decks. It's two different teams test together. One of the teams has good decks.
Now, can I ask you how it was decided on who got on which team, or have people ever asked it to switch teams, like switch halves of the team?
So our team, I mean, I think both teams started pretty much the same way. We started back in like 2010 around, and it wasn't like we were a formal team to begin with. It was just, these were the people I like to hang out with and test with. And Pantheon, I think, pretty much the same thing. It's not like, you know, we're professional basketball teams that scout, you know, up and comers and make strategic decisions and trades. It's more like, you know, who are the people who you want to hang out with and who you think will help you prepare well for the Pro Tour. And hopefully those overlap well enough that you can have a good time.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like you were mini-maxing and you were like, okay, we need a draft guy. We need a limited guy. We need a modern guy. We need a – that wasn't a factor at all.
No, not really. I mean, as the teams have evolved, I mean, there have been kind of different membership as, you know, some people don't go to some Pro Tours. Some people decide to start going to Pro Tours again, that sort of thing. You do kind of get a sense of what you're looking for, and I think that sometimes people are added to the team because of that. But first and foremost, it's like, could you spend a week in a house with this person? And if the answer is no, then you shouldn't be on the same team as them, because that is kind of what happens.
Right. I know I whenever I hear stories of the testing, it always sounds like the real world to me, where it's like, you know, picture eight pro players picked to live in a house, work together, have their lives taped. And I just imagine like the confessionals. And it's like, what would it be like if you guys had that little room and, you know, somebody was like, and Owen totally ate my last Oreo cookie. And yeah. I would imagine that'd be really fun to watch.
There's a lot less drama, as it turns out, than most like reality shows, which first of all, the people are just like hamming it up because they know they're on a reality show.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, there have been, you know, altercations, I suppose. Conley did tell Kibler to bring it once, and Conley was not kidding. So, but Kibler declined to bring it, as it turns out, which is very smart. I mean, Conley is gigantic.
That's very true. That's very true. And you ended up doing well at GP Portland.
Yeah, me, Eric Froelich, and Paul Chian, we made top four, actually losing to Owen, Huey, and Reed.
What was that like?
I mean, it was awesome. A really big part of that whole thing was that so Paul Chian is, you know, one of my best friends. Like, we always played Magic together. The first year that both of us played all the Pro Tours was the first year in 2007. It was like the first year where we both, you know, hit like level 7 and level 8 respectively. That's, I guess, like platinum now. They used to divide it a little differently. And that was huge. I mean, that was our entry to the Pro Tour. And, you know, we always tested together. And, you know, at the end of the 2008 season, he actually moved to Curacao to start working for Pinnacle. As it's a sports gambling website. He would, you know, set lines and, you know, kind of figure out, you know, which team was favored, that sort of thing. But he had to quit Magic to do so. I mean, he moved to an island in the Caribbean. So he only recently moved back actually to work for Channel Fireball, which is awesome. He's the retail store manager for the actual Channel Fireball store in Santa Clara.
Wow.
But Paul's not qualified for the Pro Tour anymore. So, and it was hard for me to imagine having a Pro Tour and having Paul not be able to go. Mm-hmm. And if we went, you know, 13-2 in Portland, then he would get qualified because that's how you qualify for the Pro Tour. And so we were 7-2 at one point, but we 6-0'd our last six rounds there to qualify Paul for the Pro Tour.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the two teams, you know, it has been a good year for Channel Fireball in general. And what do you think is it that makes these two teams so successful compared to all the other teams out there?
Well, Pantheon's had a much more successful year. I mean, I have to admit that. Like, there, you know, there's years where we had great years, and this year they had a great year, and we actually did not. So, I mean, we had an okay one, but certainly not kind of like what we had hoped. Mm-hmm. And so I can't really speak to what they're doing right because, you know, I mean, I don't know exactly what they're doing. I think a big difference between the two teams is a lot of the people in our teams don't, you know, can't play full-time Magic anymore. Like, some of us used to be able to, like myself. But right now they have a lot of guys who play Magic, you know, all the time. And that's awesome. Those people should do better at Magic tournaments than people like me or Pat Cox, you know, who have to like work 40-hour weeks and then try to fit in Magic in between that. So that's one difference between them and us. They're also meeting for a little bit longer, though we met for a full 2 weeks the last Pro Tour. So I think that's the real key, by the way, is the teams that are going to have the most success are the teams that meet in person where everyone's in the same location for as long as you can, because testing and then trying to like disseminate the results online is just not as effective. Mm-hmm.
What was it like testing for this Pro Tour with Standard being the format and people seeming to think that Standard had kind of gone stale? You know, we were seeing a lot of the same decks that we saw in October of last year that really hadn't gone anywhere. Like, what was the mood like?
It was by far the worst testing I've ever had. It just, after the first 3 days, we tried all the, like, you know, I was like, oh, look, we tried these Court of Calling, you know, Green Devotion decks. We tried Yisan the Wandering Bard. We tried different Ensoul Artifact decks. A couple days of that, and we're like, yep, all these decks suck. Let's try to figure out what, you know, what the best mono black list is, what the best mono blue list is. Mm-hmm. How can we make red? How can we make a Sphinx's Revelation deck? And it's not that these decks are inherently bad or the format's inherently bad. I think the people who are saying that are incorrect. I think the problem is it didn't change enough. Like you said, since last October, it's been the same format. Mm-hmm. Four sets have come out or whatever. Three sets have come out. And decks are still five cards off from where they were 8 months ago.
Yeah.
As a result, it wasn't fun to playtest because it felt pointless. And it was kind of a low point. Like, I was having so little fun doing it that I was seriously wondering whether I was going to even bother next year. But having new formats like Pro Tour Cons and Tarkir, I'm really looking forward to it because it's a completely new format, I think. And I think that, from the – we've seen, a couple cards, previewed from Cons already, and they look pretty awesome. So I have high hopes that this year is going to be way better, and because a couple more Pro Tours like last one, and it's not that I would quit Magic and stop playing. It's that I would stop meeting early to test for the Pro Tour, because if I can just pull a list off Magic Online that's five cards off of the list I test for, I have better things to do with 2 weeks than to test for a Pro Tour. I mean, I love playing at Pro Tours, don't get me wrong. They're really fun, and I like playing Magic, but I don't like playing the Mono Black versus the Mono Blue Magic for the 700th time.
Sure, I get it completely. I know, I felt the same way when I started reading the Channel Fireball articles that were coming out after the Pro Tour, and guys like Frank Karsten and Paul Rietzel, and they were posting these lists of the decks that they tested, and they were good decks. Like, they were decks that I would look at while I'm sitting at home going, oh, these decks look like so much fun, and I would totally play these decks, and just seeing the sheer number of them that were discarded because it was bad against Mono Black or it was bad against Mono Blue, and those had to be the matchups they had to stand up against. And even as a reader, it kind of bummed me out because it was like, God, there's so much potential here, and it just couldn't hold up to that. And that was a bummer.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's a shame that, like, M15 comes out, there's a lot of new cool cards, and it turns out none of those cards are as good as the cards that have been out for a year and a half. And that's unfortunate when that happens. I hope that steps will be taken to prevent that. And I think the new standard rotation that Mark Rosewater just announced is going to go a long way. It's going to make it impossible for the decks to stay the same for more than a couple months. At the very least, every 6 months, the format's going to rotate completely.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you one of the people that was initially upset at the thought of no Modern Pro Tour? Did that bother you at all?
No, not at all. No. I don't love playing Modern. I think Modern's fun. I think it's a good format. I don't think it's a great Pro Tour format. The way I see it, Pro Tours really should showcase the last set or the newest set. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the reason is, like, the set comes out, then the Pro Tour is 2 weeks later. It's so you can kind of see, what new deck building possibilities the new set came out with, how's the new draft format, all that stuff. And Modern is such a big and powerful format that a new set's not going to change it that much. So, like, Pro Tour Born of the Gods, that was the Modern Pro Tour in Valencia this year. The most played Born of the Gods card in the Pro Tour was Spring Leaf Drum, mm-hmm. which is very clearly a reprint. So it's not – I mean, there every set – just because the power level of Modern so high, you can't have very many cards that will impact it. It's just, what would those cards do to Standard? If you had a set that had 20 cards that were good in Modern, I hate to see what Standard would look like. Sure. So I think that Modern's a great format, and I actually like Modern Grand Prix. I've enjoyed playing in the Modern GPs this year. But I think for a Pro Tour, I'm not sure if it meets the goals of a Pro Tour. Mm-hmm. That being said, I like that Wizards listened to the public outcry and made a Modern Pro Tour just for at least, showing the fact that, like, they care about what people say.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I was actually one of the people who was a little upset about that because I was a Standard fan for the longest time. I only played Standard. And with this current Standard season, I lost a lot of interest. I got very tired, like you said, of the Mono Blue versus Mono Black, and I gravitated towards Modern and loved it. I started off playing Living End. I didn't want to invest in a Tier 1 deck right away because I wasn't sure I would like the format. I recently just invested in Junk, Willie Edel's Junk version, and I love the format. And I have a lot of plans on getting good at the deck and going to the GPs next year. And I was very sad to hear that there would be no Modern Pro Tour. And I was very happy when they reinstated one because I really, really do love the format. I have a lot of respect for the win conditions. I appreciate so many of the cards and so many of the crazy ideas. And I'm glad it's back. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely understandable. Modern is a fun format. And I certainly don't want to dissuade people from playing Modern because I do think it's great. I think the same... the same benefit would have been served by having a bunch of Modern Grand Prix, but I do understand the desire to see, the coverage of a Modern Pro Tour that's going to be a lot more in-depth than coverage of a Grand Prix. So that does make sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, GP Portland was the second GP this year that you made a top eight showing in, correct?
Yeah, GP Richmond was the other one.
Yeah, speaking of Modern, has your perspective on doing well or winning changed since you became a Hall of Famer or just from being, from doing what you do for so long?
I don't know if getting into the Hall of Fame has changed, I guess, my perspective too much. It has some. Mm-hmm. I don't feel the pressure to grind to maintain results every year because I don't have to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am lucky enough to be in the position where if I have a year like I had last year, like this last year after, you know, had I not been in the Hall of Fame, I would be silver and not qualified for all the Pro Tours next year. Like that my, you know, I did not have a good year. I had a couple of Grand Prix top eights. I guess I only had the one Grand Prix top eight last year because Portland's the first event of this season, mm-hmm. which is actually good for me. I'd rather, if I wasn't going to do well, I'd rather shift my best result to the start of the next season. But either way, because I don't have to requalify every year, being on the Pro Tour lets me take a step back, or in the Hall of Fame lets me take a step back, because if I have a disappointing year and I want to dial it back, I can just do that. I don't have the, you know, the consequence of, like, if I don't get gold, I don't get to play next year, which a lot of people do. So I certainly don't take that for granted.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back in time a little bit, Luis. So you were born and raised in Oakland, California.
Yep.
And you have two brothers, correct?
That's true.
Okay. What were you like as a kid? What was your childhood like?
I certainly was like a nerdy kid growing up. You know, my interests actually haven't changed all that much, you know, since like I learned how to play Magic when I was 11.
Wow.
My best friend Seth introduced me to it. I mean, we each bought a starter deck of Revised and some packs of Dark and just played without really knowing the rules. We didn't really play correctly for a long time, but that's, you know, so I've been playing Magic for, I'm 31 now, so 20 years, which is a long time. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of reading, played Magic. I mean, I was in the Boy Scouts, so I did some amount of outdoor activities, which I still like to do. I still like hiking, and what's one of the best things about moving to Colorado is actually the hiking is really awesome here.
Did you get very far in Boy Scouts? Like, were you an Eagle Scout at all?
I basically had all the requirements done for Eagle Scout except the actual Eagle project, which okay. I just didn't do. So, which I do semi-regret. Like, my interest in the whole thing had faded so much that I just couldn't bring myself to do it. On the other hand, I mean, I should have just finished it. I had spent so much time in the Boy Scouts that there wasn't really a reason not to besides the fact that I just didn't have the desire.
But, do you remember what the project was?
Well, no, I had to come up with it. Like, part of the Eagle Scout project is you come up with a charitable project or a project that will do good for the community, and you like present your plans for it. It gets approved, and then you have to like get a lot of people to help you with it. Like, part of the idea is to demonstrate leadership by getting other people, mostly which other Boy Scouts in your troop, to help you carry that project out. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I actually didn't do that. So.
So what was it about Magic at that age and as you got older that kept you interested and made you want to be competitive with it?
The funny thing was I actually wasn't competitive with it for a long time. I mean, when I first got into it, it was just, you know, when you're like 11 or 12, it doesn't take much to get you to capture your imagination, I don't think. But Magic certainly did for me. I just loved playing it. I mean, I liked the art. I liked the whole like fantasy setting. I didn't really think of it as like, you know, something I would compete in. I mean, the first PTQ I played in was 10 years after I learned how to play Magic. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I jumped right into tournaments. I know some people who learned how to play Magic and 6 months later they're playing in tournaments.
Oh yeah.
I learned how to play Magic and then didn't even think about trying to qualify for the Pro Tour for years and years. I didn't even know what the Pro Tour was for a long time. So I guess my journey into that was very different than someone I think who starts playing now, just because there's so much more information now, so many more websites. Like, I mean, I started playing the year after it came out. There weren't Magic websites for a while. Like, I remember the Dojo when it came out and thinking it was like the best thing I'd ever seen. So
I remember that.
I don't know. Magic has certainly evolved for me. Like, I mean, I love trading. Like, trading to get better cards was a really big part of it, because, you know, I couldn't just buy all the cards I wanted. Like, I was certainly operating on a very limited budget, and being able to like trade and, you know, increase my collection was just a huge part of the game for me, because just acquiring cooler cards was something I wanted to do. So I guess that probably kept me in.
It is different when you are, you know, a little older and can afford cards. And it's also different if your status allows you to get cards. Like, I've done a podcast for 2 years now, The Deck Tease. This is my 100th episode. And I've been sponsored by two major websites. And in both of those cases, I was earning store credit for doing my show, where I wasn't having to pay for cards anymore. So I was able to trade that credit in for exactly what I needed. And then when I would go to F&M or I would go to an event and people would want to trade with me, I didn't really need anything, because everything I wanted, I had. Or also, as I'm sure you can relate, you can borrow cards if you have a certain amount of status. So for a while, I felt like I was missing out on part of the community because I wasn't engaging in trading. And now I've learned to, even though I might not need anything, I still want to be connected to that side of things. So I will engage in trading with people. But I didn't realize how much I missed it until I wasn't doing it. And I was seeing, you know, the social interaction that came along with it. And I realized how, you know, far removed I got from doing the show. It was very interesting.
Yeah, and I understand that. I honestly can't conceive of, you know, ever trading again. Like at this point, if I want a card, I'll probably buy it or ask to borrow it or what have you. Like, I mean, it's not even like ask to borrow it. Like, I'm one of the owners of a Magic website, so I'm not even like so I'm lending myself cards in that sense. But I do collect a lot of cards still. I still like cards. I mean, before GP, you know, the morning of GP Richmond, I bought 4 Beta Birds of Paradise because I wanted to play with them. Like, I care about that stuff probably way too much. Like, I mean, I spent a decent amount of money on cards this year, and none of it was cards I, like, needed to have or I wouldn't be able to play. It was all, like, I want Beta Birds. I want, like, a Beta Badlands or, like, you know, Foil Flooded Strands or whatever, just because I like my cards looking pretty, so okay. It is one of my vices, I suppose.
Nothing wrong with that. I know once I started getting into Modern and once I started investing money into it, same thing. I started springing for the John Avon lands. I was like, just because I use basics doesn't mean they have to be basic. I was like, no. Exactly. So I get it, Louise. Now, the first Pro Tour that you qualified for was Pro Tour San Diego in 2004. And you said something interesting in your Hall of Fame profile about how you were excited to qualify for that because you could drive to it and how flying to a tournament didn't make any sense. What did you mean by that?
So I had started playing in PTQs the year before, and I actually top aided a bunch of PTQs for other pro tours that I didn't intend on going to. And I conceded in the top eight of
what?
A couple PTQs. I just didn't want to go to the pro tours because I wasn't really interested in playing in the Pro Tour, and I didn't want to, like, buy a flight to one. I was like, that just seems like too much of a hassle. I can just play Magic tournaments here. So, but then when I found out that there was going to be a Pro Tour in San Diego and I knew I could drive down there, I was like, oh, actually, you know, I would like to play in that one. So then I won a PTQ for that and was able to go play in it.
Interesting. You went to PTQs without looking to be in the Pro Tour.
Yeah, I mean, I played in PTQs because I played at, like, the local store in actually Davis, California, because I went to college in Davis and to UC Davis, and I would just play at the local store. I would draft, you know, a couple times a week, and you know, some of the guys were like, "Hey, there's a PTQ this Saturday. You should come." And I'm like, "I don't know. I've never played in a PTQ before." They're like, "No, it'll be fun." So I got a constructed deck. It was for Onslaught Block constructed, and actually, my very first PTQ, I played against David Ochoa for top eight, and I conceded to him. I mean, I'd known Webb for a long, his nickname is Webb, which I think most people get because he's called that intermittently or interchangeably by most of us. But I'd known him for a long time even before that, so it wasn't much of a decision for me. He wanted to go and I didn't, so I just conceded to him.
Why do they call him Webb? You have to tell me.
So the reason was is Webb can be kind of a know-it-all, so it was like Webb as in Webster's Dictionary.
Oh.
But he has a lot of nicknames, like the Ocho. So I think, you know, you can call Webb in a number of things and he'll respond. Though for the most part, he introduces himself as David. So I think that he's kind of moving towards just being called that. But we still call him Webb. We've earned it.
With that said, though, have you ever enjoyed the traveling aspect of what you do, like the back and forth? And because I have had some people on my show who've said that that's part of the reason they don't want that lifestyle is there's just too much traveling and they don't want to be living in airports and not having a lot of time at home and things like that.
Oh, I actually love the travel. When I said it didn't make sense for me to go fly to a pro tour is just because I didn't conceive of Magic tournament being important enough for me to like fly to it. Of course, my perspective on that has changed. I travel pretty well. Like I can just fall asleep on airplanes. Like it's not a big deal. So I don't mind like red eyes. Like, you know, some of the more convenient tournaments I've gone to, I've gone, you know, flown a red eye, slept the whole flight and then gone and played in the tournament and felt fine. So,
wow.
And I have really loved going to a lot of the different places. Like I feel really lucky that I've gotten to go to Japan a bunch of times and I've gotten to go to Europe a bunch of times, places that I don't think I would have been able to go to, or at least go to as easily as, you know, except via Magic. That being said, I don't want to sound jaded here, but I've traveled enough that if every pro tour could be in the United States, I would be fine with that. Mm-hmm. Specifically, like San Diego. Or Portland, actually. Portland is one of my favorite places. I was really happy to get two events there.
Yeah, had you been there before?
I had, for other Magic events. And the food in Portland is just amazing. I mean, I love food. It's like one of my favorite things is thinking about what I'm going to eat, cooking food in order to eat, or finding good food to eat. So Portland's kind of like a paradise because they have all these food trucks that are insane, all these restaurants that are awesome. So that goes a long way in me choosing which locations I like best.
What do you recall about that first Pro Tour experience, if anything? Like, what stood out to you about that?
I remember a lot about it, actually. I remember having a split with my friend Arun, who made top 16, so I won a couple $100. That felt awesome. I remember playing against Ifro and him beating me in, like, 5 minutes and not saying a word, and I didn't talk to him for 7 years after that because I didn't know him. Like, we didn't really actually meet until much, much later. So I remember playing against Jerry T, actually, and Jerry had an Arcslogger, so a 4/5/5, and you can pay a red and exile your top 10 cards to deal 2 to anything.
Sure.
So you can use it like twice in limited, and you won't really have too much of a problem with being decked. So he attacks me with this Arcslogger, and I block with like 5 creatures, and I have 2 combat tricks, and I think for sure that I'm going to be able to get this off the board. So, you know, he uses Arcslogger like I expected him. I cast a combat trick. He activates it again. I cast another combat trick, you know. We stack damage, and then he plays Scale of Chisgoria. It's a artifact with flash that taps to give a creature +0/+1.
Oh.
And this is back when damage stacked, so I couldn't actually, you know, deal any more damage to it. So At the end of that exchange, nothing went to his graveyard, and like one Galvanic Blast went to his graveyard, Electrostatic Bolt, the old Galvanic Blast, and like all my creatures went to my graveyard. Mm. So I actually played Jerry in my second Pro Tour, and he also beat me there. And at that point, he probably thought I was some random dude he'd never heard of who he just easily beat twice. But yeah, I mean, my first Pro Tour was awesome. It really it actually gave me the fire more than anything else. Like, I played in it and was like, okay, yeah, this is awesome. I would like to play more of these, even though I went 8-7. I mean, I made day 2, which I was happy about, but I didn't end up cashing. So it was such a fun experience that it made me want to play more Pro Tours, and I was able to, you know, obviously play in a lot more Pro Tours after that.
You got bit by the bug, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely.
I was reading your Hall of Fame profile, Luis, and you said something interesting about your first Pro Tour top 8 in Berlin. You said the friendships are really why we are at the Pro Tour. What did you mean by that?
I mean, that still holds true today. It's If you look at the what you get out of, you know, top 8ing a Pro Tour, doing well in tournaments. I mean, certainly the money is not why any of us play, because, winning a Pro Tour definitely pays a lot, but I've, you know, won one Pro Tour ever. It's not like I expect that to happen very often, and it is expensive to go to these events. I mean, doing well does offset that. In fact, you make a little bit, but the real reason to play is that you enjoy doing it, and part of the enjoyment, a big part of it, is, you know, the people you're spending your time with. Like Paulo Vitor is like one of my closest friends, and without Magic, I don't even know how we would see each other. He lives in Brazil, I live here, but because of Magic tournaments, I see him many, many times a year, and I get to spend a lot of time with him, and that's, you know, incredible. Mm-hmm. So Magic has really gone a long way, and, you know, I've made a lot of lifelong friends. I'm sure if I didn't play in any more tournaments, I would still see a ton of these guys.
I was really surprised when I had Kai Buda on my show a couple of months ago, and I had asked him why he had cut back on playing or why he lost interest in the game. And I was surprised that a lot of his reasons revolved around the friendships, and that the people that he, you know, kind of moved up through the ranks with, or that he, you know, was successful with, weren't playing anymore. And to somebody like me, I would think that the success alone would be enough, because he was still doing quite well. Like, he did go out, you know, at the top of his game, if you will. But without having people to share that success with, without people that he enjoyed playing with, he didn't really feel like playing anymore. And it's interesting that, you know, the success alone, you know, the titles, you know, the standings alone were not enough, and the, you know, the Hall of Fame alone was not enough, and, you know, he just wanted those people there with him. I thought that was really interesting. So,
yeah, I completely know where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I've not had anywhere near the success Kai's had, because nobody has, and nobody probably will. But if your friends aren't doing well, if your friends aren't enjoying themselves, or if you're not getting to see your friends, like, it's just not worth it. I've I went to a Grand Prix once in Madrid, which, I mean, it was fun to go to. I have actually family there, so I was able to stay with them, and that was really cool. Get to see my cousins and my uncle and all that. But when I was at the tournament site, this was not very many people I knew were there, and it was a huge tournament. It was actually, it set a record for being the biggest Magic tournament of all time at the time it was held. It was like 2,200 people or something. The tournament itself was just not fun. I mean, I was sitting there, and I would finish my round, win or lose, and there'd be no one I knew around me. And no one I knew anywhere close. So I just kind of sat around, you know, walked around, you know, till the next round started. That, I mean, that's just not enjoyable. Whereas at almost every tournament I go to now, you win your round, you get to go see if your friends won. You get to go talk to them. You get to go, you know, complain to them if you lost or hear their complaints. It's part of being a friend is listening to the bad beats. you get to listen to the awesome plays that happen to them. You get to do all the stuff. And if you don't have that, I just can't imagine, you know, dragging myself to tournaments.
Sure. Sure. So tell me how you first became associated with Channel Fireball.
Actually, it was one of the people who helped found it. I was working for AdventuresOn.com, actually, which is now Blackborder.com, which is a website that still exists.
And I'm
very grateful that I was able to work for them. That was kind of like my first job within the magic industry. And the sponsorship from Avram, the owner, was, you know, huge in getting me and Paul to the tournaments we went to and kind of like onto the train. But when I was approached by the guys from who would be Channel Fireball, they're actually Superstars was the name back then, but Superstars.com was already taken and the guy wanted a lot for it. So we're like, all right, whatever. We've got a better idea. So, but when they talked to me, they had this vision for this website and the fact that I would get to, you know, kind of help them build it and make a lot of the decisions, you know, with the coming from the perspective of someone who'd played a lot of Magic and knew, you know, what would make good content and also like, you know, starting to make draft videos. Like, you know, we're kind of the first on the scene making draft videos as far as I can recall and back in like Shards of Alara. And that was all that was really exciting. And so I decided to join them and, you know, we built the website and we've grown a lot since we started. It was certainly, you know, there was tough times, like just, it was a lot of work and we didn't have a lot of people. I mean, actually Ricky Hayashi was one of the early editors and, you know, a really big part of getting the website off the ground. So certainly owe him for that still. But I've been there since day one. That's just, it is, you know, the thing I've devoted a lot of my time to over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually you decided to form a team called Team Channel Fireball. And you did this at a time when teams weren't so common anymore. Like there seemed to be, you know, a decline in the number of teams that were being formed or that were prevalent. What made you decide to form a team?
Yeah, like we were talking about earlier, it wasn't that I sat down and like, you know what I need? I need a team. It was more like, hey, you know, I'm testing with Paulo. I'm testing with like Josh Utterleighton. I'm testing with David Ochoa, Brian Kibler. Like these are all, you know, Eric Froelich, who actually, this is kind of how we met him. We didn't really know him, but through working together, we actually got to know him a lot better. Conley Woods, you know, joined us eventually. Like these are all my friends who I wanted to spend time with. And since we were all testing together and since, you know, we're all, a lot of us basically, almost all of us wrote for Channel Fireball in one capacity or another, made videos or whatever. We decided to, you know, call ourselves Team Channel Fireball because that made the most sense. And I found it funny that this, yeah, at the time, not very many people were meeting in kind of like the organized team fashion. I think people, I mean, honestly, part of the reason we had so much success the first couple of years was that we were among the few groups of people who were actually meeting, you know, face to face for over a week, which now almost everyone does. And that I think consequently is part of the reason that we're having, you know, we're winning less is just other people are preparing better. So the Pro Tour is much harder now. I'd be willing to bet that if you look at the, you know, attendance of the next Pro Tour, like a very large part of the field is on one of these organized teams, you know, one of the many, many teams that exist now, just because I think that is the best way to prepare for the tournament. Mm-hmm.
So in 2009, you got married to your lovely wife.
I did.
Found the website that you two set up for your wedding, and
that she set up. I played no part in it except for providing some of the content. But
that sounds like the typical role of a groom at most weddings. They just sort of back off and let the wife handle all the planning and things like that.
I think the fairest way is to the person who cares more about what is like the actual trappings of what is happening gets to make the decisions.
So you were happy just to be married?
Yes, definitely.
So there were lots of photos on the website. There were lots of neat stories, which I found and I enjoyed. And one thing I was really surprised to see is that she actually proposed to you.
She did, actually, when we were in Italy. Actually, we went on a trip there. It wasn't like a trip with a specific reason. It was just, you know, we had the opportunity and, you know, were able to go there. And we went to Rome for like – and a couple other cities for, I guess it was like 2 weeks. And one of the days she proposed to me and I said yes.
That's lovely. And I was even more amused by the fact that you two met over cake.
Well, more specifically, the fact that I don't like cake. Yeah.
How can you not like cake?
I can't really explain it. I mean, I like cheesecake or ice cream cake, but actual cake with, like, you know, I don't know, just the bready sort of yellow cake is just not something that interests me in any way. Which is weird because I like so many kinds of food, but cake is just not one of them.
So if you had to choose between cake or pie, you would be on team pie?
Oh, yeah. Not even close.
Louise.
Oh. I know.
So basically, if I understand this correctly, she made a cake and then she asked if you wanted some and you said no. And then you ended up talking and...
Yeah, she was displeased with that answer. So she investigated further. And upon such things, I guess relationships are formed.
So I've always wondered this about, you know, pro players like yourself who get involved in relationships. How do you tell somebody that you are LSV, that you are a pro, that you have this following, that you are essentially a celebrity in Magic? Like, what was that talk like?
Well, we started dating kind of before a lot of that was the case. Like, I was already playing Magic by the time I met her, and I was already going to tournaments, you know, but it wasn't, it was very different. Like, you know, I guess now 8 years ago or something along those lines, 9 years ago. And it, I mean, so she's kind of seen the evolution of it and she's amused by it. She likes it. She thinks it's funny.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something I had to explain. And like, I guess now it would be different. I mean, also now, like, a, you know, routine thing to do when you meet someone that you're like interested in is like Google them, right? Like, I can't imagine how that would go now if I were like, I mean, the thing is, I've never really hidden the fact that I play Magic and that it's a big part of my life. I really can't. I mean, I spent so much time on it and so much energy on it that even people I just, you know, casually meet often find out about it pretty quickly if they don't already know, just because it's hard for me not to like that to bleed into all aspects of my life. So it's, I mean, I understand why some people are reticent to like explain that they play Magic. Like, that is a more, it is a more like younger, it's a mentality I think more common among younger people who, you know, maybe think Magic isn't cool, but I don't think there's any reason to do that. I'm not ashamed of it in any way. And I think, you know, geeky stuff is getting more accepted these days. And I think people are a lot more open about that sort of thing than maybe they were when like I was in high school. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it also might have to do with the fact, you know, when I had Kibler on my shows, it was like, you know, what comes along with dating a pro player, where especially if you are dating somebody who's on the grind, you know, I'm going to be at this GP and this GP and this GP and this pro tour, and then I'm taking 2 weeks before this pro tour to do this. And they have to be understanding of the lifestyle that comes along with that. And some people, like I have a friend who's a musician, and his job, you know, he's touring a lot, and he's got rehearsals, and you know, sometimes the band doesn't always make a lot of money, and he needs to be with somebody who understands that. So I was thinking more in terms of, you know, making sure that they're in line with that and that they understand, you know, what your life is like when you're on the grind.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely something that you have to work around. Part of the way that, you know, we've made that work is that she's gone to a number of events in cool places, like, you know, Worlds in Chiba or Pro Tour San Juan or another, you know, Worlds in Rome. Like, being able, and like, we went to a Grand Prix in Australia like 2 years ago, being able to go to some of the travel and like get some of the benefit definitely helps. Cause I mean, that's exciting and it's fun. It's also the sort of thing where like we knew going in kind of what the expectations were and what my schedule was looking like. I mean, this was like, I was just a full-time Magic player before this and I did have to go to a lot of events. So it's something that has always kind of been present and we've luckily been able to make it work. I think that part of the reason it does work is that, you know, she's all right with me doing this, though. She actually just started her doctoral program. She's getting a PhD, and so now she's actually a lot busier than I am, which the tables have turned, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So how do you manage to juggle everything that you do? Because you're doing the competitive Magic thing, you write for the mothership, and you occasionally write for Channel Fireball, videos, the day job, marriage. How do you keep it all in check?
Well, part of it is I eat really quickly. So.
But not
well,
cake.
That actually, that actually is true. I do eat really quickly, but that it doesn't save that much time. I am a lot more efficient than I used to be. I used to have a lot of time, and I used to therefore not have to use it very well. So, you know, I would kind of do things when I felt like doing them and kind of get them done as I saw fit. Now that doesn't really work. Now my time is pretty well segmented, where I don't have a ton of free time anymore. But I mean, part of the thing that's cool is that a lot of the work stuff I do, I mean, it is work. It definitely like is difficult or, you know, takes a lot of time, but it's also really fun. So I don't necessarily need like when part of my job is recording, you know, matches of vintage, it's not like I need a break from that. That kind of is my break in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a ton of free time to do non-magic stuff, but a lot of the magic stuff I do is still a lot of fun and I still enjoy it. So that helps. And then, yeah, I just have to make sure I use my time wisely. I mean, I don't like when I go to events now, I leave Friday after work and I get back Sunday night almost universally. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely less time than I'm used to. Like it is, I used to, you know, fly into Grand Prix Friday afternoon, leave Monday afternoon and kind of, you know, take my time. Now it's like, yeah, I'm on the like 9 p.m. flight, lands at midnight, go play in the Grand Prix, leave right from the site Sunday at 5 p.m. And it's a little more stressful, but that's the way I can make it work. My option is to either not go to the Grand Prix or, you know, do this. So it's more difficult. And I don't know how, you know, I plan on dialing it back a bit this year. Like I went to a lot more last year than I thought I was going to. And I think this year I'm already kind of planning on going to less just because I don't want to keep this rate up. I don't think I can.
So I want to talk about food because you recently lost quite a bit of weight, Mr. Scott Vargas. You look fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you.
I saw you at a GP Minneapolis and I was like, is that him? Like whole new man. What brought this on? Like what made you decide to do this?
So actually the way this started was a bet between myself, Brad Nelson and Gabe Walls. A lot of your listeners might not be familiar with Gabe since he's doesn't play much Magic anymore, but I mean, he won Team Worlds a bunch of years ago. He has, you know, done a lot in Magic, but back a couple years ago, he still played, and we just made a weight loss bet where we each wanted to lose, you know, around 20% of our body weight, and it was like a year long bet, and that certainly gave me the incentive. The actual weight loss is unfortunately much less exciting. It's just I would spend a lot more time, you know, getting exercise. I would make that a higher priority, and I eat better food and I kind of eat less of it because my appetite is apparently unstoppable if I just let myself eat. So I've learned to not eat, you know, to the point where I'm just stuffed anymore. Like, which, so I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a battle I'll always have, but it's also like, I just love food, but I just have, you know, learned to focus on eating food that I like that is also healthy. Cause I mean, I love eating like grilled chicken. I like eating, you know, I like a lot of different kinds of salad. I like a lot of different kinds of vegetables. As long as I can focus on that most of the time, I can still eat all the other stuff I want to eat. I just have to make sure to balance it better.
Mm-hmm. See, my problem is I'm an emotional eater. So if everything is going well in my life, I can stick to an eating plan and I can eat well and eat healthy. But if I have a bad day at work, I go straight to Culver's and I get a double waffle cone of vanilla and I'm sobbing in the ice cream cone about how terrible things are. Or if I have a really good day, like let's say I get a bonus at work, I'm ordering Chinese takeout and I'm celebrating. And I need to learn not to use food, you know, to convey emotions or to feel things, or, you know, you eat sometimes and there's an emotion associated with that where, like, you know, some people tomato soup, you know, they're kids again and it's cold outside and they get that good feeling. And I have too many feelings tied to food and I need to really cut that cord. And I recently started eating better and I was surprised by how good it felt to know what hunger felt like. Yeah. In a really sick way. I don't mean like, you know, third world hunger or anything, but, you know, I used to be somebody who would eat till I was stuffed, like you said, and I never knew what it was like to be just full. You're not, you know, gorged. You're not overboard. You're full. And to know what it's like when your next meal's coming up and you've got that little twinge of, well, that's what hunger feels like. And it's okay to feel that. And yeah, that's how I knew I was on the right track.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten used to the fact that like I pack my, you know, I try to pack lunches for work, you know, take to work most of the days, and I'll eat my lunch. And if a couple hours later I'm like, you know, hungry, I'm like, look, I know I had enough food. I know I can just wait until I eat dinner. I mean, sometimes I'll eat, like I try to also keep healthy snacks around, like, you know, almonds or like beef jerky or that sort of thing, hard boiled eggs, just to, because sometimes I'm not gonna wait till I'm so hungry that I'm like distracted. But if I'm a little hungry, that's fine. I can survive. I mean, I completely know what you mean about the emotional eating part. Like, I know part of the reason magic's been rough for me is that when I do badly, I tend to, like, you know, eat to make myself feel better. And I did enough losing last year that would not have gone well if if I didn't get that under control. Like, I mean, it still kind of happens, but at least I'm aware of it and, you know, can take steps to prevent it. I mean, I don't feel that bad about it because, again, I just love eating, you know, good food so often. And when I'm at a, you know, at a magic tournament, it means I'm somewhere else where I'm able to get stuff I'm not able to get normally. So that kind of justifies it a little bit. But yeah, it is definitely tougher when, you know, you do badly for the fourth straight pro tour and it's like, man, you know what would make me feel better? A milkshake.
So 2013, you're inducted into the Hall of Fame. You received over 95% of the vote and were the first inductee into your class. How did it feel to finally get in there?
It was awesome. I mean, it was just incredible to have, you know, the fact that I spent so much time and so much effort and put it all into this game and to get recognized for that was awesome. I mean, a lot of people spend a lot of time and a lot of effort and do not get recognized for it. So the fact that I was able to, that I was lucky enough to, you know, have the results and the different, you know, meet the qualifications necessary, and the fact that so many of the voters thought I deserved to be in the Hall of Fame, it just felt awesome. It was definitely, you know, one of the high points of my life.
Mm-hmm. One of the noteworthy things about you, Luis, is that you are one of the most beloved members of the Hall of Fame. People love you. They literally love you. I have never heard anything bad about you. And I hang out with some catty people, and they can find something terrible about anybody. I've gone to events, and I've seen the look in people's eyes when they ask you to sign their playmats or sign their cards. You're a nice guy. You're a big advocate for good sportsmanship. How important is that reputation to you?
It is very important. I mean, I try not to, like, you know, have like a calculated public persona or anything like that. But I also kind of feel that if I'm having a bad day because, like, you know, I just, like, a perfect example is, like, I just took a tough loss at a tournament and someone's like, hey, do you want to sign my playmat? Some part of me is like, no, I want to go sulk about the fact that I just lost. But it's not this person's fault that I just lost. And there's absolutely no reason for me to make their day worse. So I'm not, like, faking it when I'm friendly to these people. Certainly not. I am perhaps not displaying the fact that I feel pretty bad sometimes, but I think that I don't need to do that. I mean, I can vent to my friends. I can wait until, you know, it's a better time and a place to do that. But I mean, I don't know. I in general am very friendly just because I like, you know, making people feel good and I like seeing people happy. That's a lot of what I want to do, is to just kind of express that. And also, like, a lot of the personality that I think that comes through, like, my videos or whatever, is just kind of how I, you know, interact with the world. Like, you know, I like great jokes. And even though if some people, you know, think they're kind of stupid, I actually know that they're great. Like, I know that in my core. So I don't worry about that too much. Yeah, definitely.
The puns. All the puns.
Yeah. I mean, again, I keep saying that I'm lucky, but I'm not actually being modest. I actually do believe that I'm lucky in the sense that the personality I have and the things I enjoy, the things I just like to do, have, you know, struck a chord with people, and people like that. And that's awesome. That's just, I mean, it's just very fortunate that I don't have to act very different than what I normally want to act to kind of accomplish the things I want to accomplish. Like, you know, I like the, you know, that kind of humor. I like, you know, just, the way I act is kind of the way I like to act, and luckily that's what people like. So it is important to me. I do think that you shouldn't make other people's day worse, but it's also, I don't know. I just, where I've ended up, I think is fortunate based on just kind of, I guess, what people, the combinations of things that people like people like magic videos. They like, you know, sweet jokes, and they like things that are funny, and I apparently am able to fit those qualifications.
And it seems like, you know, the side of you that they're getting through these videos, or the side of you that they're getting in the articles or at the events, that's you all the time. You know, you're not just being, you know, on for them. Like, you know, we could go to your office and see you make these jokes, or we could see you, you know, being that way.
Right. That, yeah.
Or we could see you being that way with your wife. You know, that's you all the time.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it is, like I said, it's, I don't always display the full range of emotions that I'm feeling, but I mean, nobody does. Like, when you talk to someone, you know, when you say, "Hey, how's it going?" Someone's response is, you know, fine. It's not actually this and this and this and this. But that being said, I mean, my team can attest to it. Like, I haven't, you know, felt great at all these events. Like, I mean, winning is something I like to do and something that I've had a good taste of, and not winning these last, you know, couple of years has been pretty tough. But on the other hand, I've kind of been able to take a step back. I think I'm in a little better spot now, just because I'm not going to say I care less, but I'm less invested in the results for, you know, if that's a different, I don't know, but I'm kind of just approaching this year as like, well, let's just see what happens. I'm doing coverage at more Grand Prix this year because I would rather cover them than play in them. And if I do well in the first Pro Tour, then maybe I'll play in more Grand Prix than I was planning on. But if I don't, it's not the end of the world. I've enjoyed a lot of success at Magic tournaments, and I don't need to enjoy success at every tournament in order to have a good time. I think if I approach it that way, I'm not going to have a good time. So I would rather kind of approach it in a way that makes me enjoy it. Like, as long as I feel like I'm playing well, I'm going to be pretty happy about that. If winning comes along with that, great, I'll be even happier. But the part where I don't like is I don't like feeling bad because I'm playing bad. I think if I play to a standard that I think is good, then I'll be happy even if I don't have the results to back it up. I would rather have the results, but I just want to do the best I can do.
My friend Maria once said that she has gotten to the point where she almost wishes that you do bad at events because she loves you in the coverage booth that much.
Well, I am going to be in the booth more. I would love to do well at the Pro Tours, but I don't mind covering Grand Prix, and I'm going to be planning on doing a fair amount of coverage this year. So like there's already a couple of Grand Prix coming up that I'm going to be in the booth the whole time for. So she will get that. As long as she lets me win at the Pro Tour, then I'll be happy.
So at this point in your career, Luis, like you said, there's really nothing you can't do. I mean, you're still putting up results. You produce great content for the Mothership and Channel Fireball. People enjoy your commentary in the booth. What's next for you? Like, where do you see yourself in the next few years?
Well, I mean, a lot of the time and energy that I've spent recently has been in game design. And unfortunately, I can't really talk about what I've been doing because we haven't announced any of the projects that we're working on. But I think that's going to kind of shape the landscape of my next couple of years pretty much more than anything else. I mean, I do anticipate still doing a ton of Magic stuff. It's not like that's going to be less important, but I don't know how dramatically that's going to change. I mean, maybe I do more coverage. Maybe I do well at a Pro Tour and, you know, hit Platinum again. Like, regardless of what I do there, I don't anticipate quitting Magic or playing a ton more Magic. But if professionally some of the projects that I'm working on end up doing well, that could be a big thing for me.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on to some reader submitted questions, because I put the call out there. If people had any questions for you, I would choose a couple and ask you them. And let's go ahead and rattle those off. So at Pat Uglow on Twitter, he asks, how do you define the skill set for a great deck builder? And would you rather be the person who builds the decks or pilots them?
Well, I think there's rewards on both sides, certainly. History is littered with examples of someone builds a deck, someone else does well in a tournament, the second person gets a lot of the credit. that happens less now because now the information is so much more out there. But like, you know, the Sly deck, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Sly. That's the original red deck with a mana curve and, you know, orcs and aggressive. It was played by Paul Sly, but actually Jay Schneider is the guy who built it. It's not called the Schneider deck. It's called the Sly deck.
So, I didn't even know it was named after a person. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was named after the first person to play it and do well in a tournament with it. And that's an example of, like, you know, getting it all. You got to play and win the prizes and get the credit. Not that he took the credit, but that's just what everyone called it. Mm-hmm. That happens less now because, again, people who build decks also get to write articles. And when you interview someone who is playing a deck someone else built, they'll tell you. That being said, I enjoy doing well in tournaments, and in a lot of ways, I would rather play and do well with a deck than build a deck. But if you can hit both, that's the best. I mean, I guess one of the best examples is, for me personally, is that Nationals 2007, I won with a deck playing Court of Calling and Arcanus. And it was just one of the most enjoyable tournaments of my life because me, David Ochoa, and Paul Cheon kind of built this deck just by ourselves, all three of us just testing. And the fact that I was able to win with a deck that I helped build, you know, and get both sides was awesome. As for what skills define a good deck builder, I mean, figuring out the metagame is a big part of it, and figuring out good, powerful things, consistent things. I mean, a lot of what you look at in just like the decks that do well, those qualities are something that you need to be able to identify.
So at Cameron Probert wants to know, what do you do when you're not playing Magic? Like nothing Magic related.
I've got a number of things. I actually recently have become a basketball fan, which is kind of weird. It's a little late to do that, but I mean, I actually went to like 5 or 6 Denver Nuggets games now that I live here, and I play basketball every week. I played yesterday, and
really?
I'm actually like super into basketball. I watch a lot of the games on TV, so that's one thing I've picked up. Like I mentioned before, I like going hiking. I do that pretty much every weekend I'm home. I go hiking just because, well, while the weather's good, which it soon won't be, unfortunately. And I like cooking. I spend a lot of time cooking and figuring out things to cook, getting, you know, acquiring ingredients and transforming them into things that taste great. Or, you know, that's a big part of what I do.
I would imagine if you like to eat, it helps to cook.
Yeah, I mean, I know that doesn't always overlap. I know people who like cooking who don't love eating as much, and I know people who love eating who just don't know how to cook or don't want to cook. But I mean, creating a great meal is something that I take a lot of joy in. I also like creating great meals for other people. Like, my wife certainly enjoys the fact that I cook a lot, and I love, like, you know, like we often do a lot of the cooking for Thanksgiving because there's a lot of transplants here in Denver where we don't go back to our families, but we're kind of out here. And so me and a bunch of coworkers and friends from around here, like, we've had Thanksgiving the last couple of years and probably will this year. And I do a lot of the cooking for that because I really like feeding like large groups of people.
Well, that's lovely. Do you cook when you're at the Pro Tour houses too?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah? I cooked a lot of meals for our team last time we met. I mean, cooking for, you know, 12 hungry dudes is can be a challenge, but it's honestly not that much more time than cooking for like 2 people. Because if you're gonna cook, I mean, just quadrupling or quintupling the ingredients is not incredibly difficult. I made like green curry with the help of Webb one day. I made grilled chicken and steak many days because that's just an easy meal that people like. So yeah, cooking is a big focus of mine.
Wow, good at Magic and can cook. It's too bad you're not single. I mean, that alone is just...
yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know what the overlap of people who that appeals to, but I guess everyone likes cooking. So. Oh.
There is an audience for that, Luis, and we will get to them in just a second. So at Zero Layfield wants to know, what is one question you've always wanted to be asked because you really look forward to answering it? Do you have one?
You know, I was trying to think about this because I saw on Twitter these questions, and I actually can't think of a great answer to this. I guess I've been asked a lot of questions that I think are awesome, and there's nothing like part of it is I have a platform to kind of talk about almost wherever I want to talk about, like between articles and doing videos and, you know, like hang out on Paul Cheon's stream and telling stories that I don't feel there's like one big thing that I've always wanted to talk about and bring up that I never have. So
okay.
I guess there's nothing too groundbreaking, unfortunately.
Nothing wrong with that. Cardboard Crack, who I adore, wants to know, what are your thoughts on the evolution of Magic card design and the future of this community?
Magic design has gotten a lot better, but that was not like a super recent development. And we're talking about like 5-6 years, something like that. Or I guess like kind of like Zendikar was one of the sets that I would point to as having kind of like the new world order, I guess, back in like 2009 or something, was a really big leap for Magic design. I mean, there's less activated abilities on board and more intuitive designs and cards like Baneslayer Angel being good instead of just cards like, you know, Tidings and Doomblade being good. So I think Magic is an incredibly well-designed game. And I think that the cards in general are just very well-designed. I mean, not 100% because you're not going to bat 1,000 on everything, but I don't think Magic is getting worse by any stretch. I think Magic is doing awesome. And I think like Innistrad is kind of like the highest point recently that I can point to where the cards were incredibly fun to play with, had incredible flavor, were very well designed. So I think Magic design is great. And I have, you know, even more of an appreciation for doing it now that I've kind of like, you know, gotten into a similar industry.
Mm-hmm. And what about the community? How do you see the community growing and changing?
It's certainly getting bigger. And I think that's awesome. I mean, I think the fact that more people like to play Magic and the community is way more connected is really big. Like, I think Twitter is a big part of that, at least for me, my experience. I'm super active on Twitter now. It took me a little while to get into it, but like the fact that I can have not only like, you know, this evening I had conversations with like, you know, Paulo and Kibler, like in a very like low pressure way where we can just like throw out you know, conversational hooks. And if they respond, cool, we'll talk. And if they don't, it's not a big deal. That also people everywhere can like watch and get involved in and ask questions about or just talk or make, you know, funny comments or whatever. Like, as you know, I was a Magic fan for a long time before I started playing in tournaments. Like, I knew who Kai was, I knew who Z was. Like, actually, Z used to do a deck clinic thing on the dojo, and I remember sending in terrible deck lists to him, and it was pretty funny. I needed to ask him if he remembers that. Not that he would remember mine specifically. There's no way that's happening. But the point is, back then I had no idea what Kai talked with Kibler about, or you know, Z talked with Finkel about. Now you can kind of get a glimpse, at least, of like the surface level conversations and kind of be involved in them. Like, I mean, it's the same for me. Like when I look at like, you know, I follow some like authors I like, you know, like Jim Butcher, author of the Dresden Files, or Brandon Sanderson, author who finished out the Wheel of Time and wrote like the Mistborn series. Like seeing the fact that they talk to people on Twitter is like amazing. Like you get to talk to people you never really thought you could talk to. And I think that and the fact that you can just get to know people just through Twitter. There's plenty of people who I like follow now on Twitter and talk to regularly who I don't have any idea how I would have met them. It's not like they go to Magic tournaments, like, but Twitter kind of brings you together. And I think that there's a lot of other, you know, social media that does the same thing. And the community as a whole it feels a lot smaller in that because it's more connected, but it's actually just much bigger overall. And I think that's awesome. I really like that evolution of it.
Oh, yeah. Fear Fluffy, I believe that's his name, at Fear Fluffy. How have you managed to maintain your love of competitive Magic for this long?
I mean, part of it is I really care whether I win or lose. Like, that certainly goes into it. Part of it is that there's new challenges and formats and things to dissect, you know, every couple months. That really helps. Like, trying to figure out how to, you know, make the best deck or draft the best deck is a really big challenge. And it's one that you have to resolve every couple months. That goes a long way. It's like, I'm sure there's people who've played chess for 50 years and loved every minute of it, but I don't know if I can imagine doing that after playing Magic. Like after playing Magic where you have something that's really difficult and really rewarding, and then it changes completely in a couple months and you have to do it all over again. Like, I mean, that's a huge challenge. So I like challenges. I'm very competitive. If you look at all the computer games or games I play, I only basically enjoy them when I'm playing as other people. Mm-hmm. Like I just single player games just don't hold much appeal to me, but the opportunity to play against and, you know, match wits against another person and then beat them is exactly what I'm looking for. But that's what drove me into Magic. And that's kind of what kept me there.
Did you ever play World of Warcraft?
I did not. I basically never played, like the MMOs, just because it's just not something that between the time commitment and the fact that, I mean, I know there's like arenas and like different things that, you know, that let you play against other people, but for the most part, I'd rather just play like I played a lot of StarCraft and, you know, that sort of thing. Like I like competing against other people directly. That's just something that's what I want out of a game.
Mm-hmm. At Strangic would like to know, what is the hardest thing about being a pro player?
Probably dealing with variance. I mean, dealing with the fact that sometimes you're going to play perfect and your opponent's going to play not well and you're going to lose. Like, it's a bitter pill to swallow, even after, you know, kind of being aware of it and swallowing it for many, many years. I mean, it's fine. I think part of the reason Magic is such a great game is that anyone can beat anyone at pretty much any point. But, you know, when you take your sixth consecutive loss to not drawing a third land, it certainly is frustrating. I will never argue that it is not.
Yeah. At Revised Angel, who is one of your biggest fans, Heather Lafferty.
Yeah, Heather's awesome.
She loves you. I don't know if you realize this, but she loves you about as much as I love Reed Duke.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten the sense of that. And you know, I think it's awesome. Like, I follow her on Twitter, and I you know, I kind of get, you know, a window into her life by watching it. That's what Twitter does. And, the fact that she's an EMT, which is just an incredibly hard job and something that's, like, you know, I have a lot of respect for. So I think, you know, that certainly impresses me. And the fact that she loves Magic is awesome, too. So I don't know. I'm actually a big fan of her. Like, I guess I don't interact with her directly, like, a ton, but I do appreciate what she does and the enthusiasm she has, especially since she, you know, deals with a lot of heavy stuff at work, I'm sure.
And you two met at GP Vegas, right?
We did, yes.
Okay, how was that?
It was cool. I mean, it was cool putting like a face to the name and, you know, meeting her in person.
I actually offered her the opportunity to come on and ask you her question directly, and she queened out so hard. She was like, "No, you do it. I can't. I love him so much." And she just totally freaked out. And I'm like, "Okay, Heather, I'll handle this." So.
Next time she should. it would have been even cooler.
Right? You know, especially being episode 100, I was really looking for like this powerful moment, and she totally chickened out on me. So that's how much she loves you. I just wanted to reinforce that. She wants to know, who is your one favorite person to play Magic with anytime, anywhere, or any place?
I've got to go with Paul Cheon. He's the person I've played one-on-one Magic against the most, I think, in my life. And, you know, it was that part of it is that so what's so wrapped up in that for me is Paul and I got good at the same time. We kind of leveled up to going from guys who played in PTQs to guys who played on the Pro Tour and did well on the Pro Tour, you know, because of each other. Like, we lived together for 2 years and we just played so much Magic against each other. And that was a huge part in us getting good. And, like, we used to have, you know, I had a cube and we'd play one-on-one cube drafts and we did hundreds of them. So I think I've got to say Paul for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Luis, it has certainly been a pleasure having you on the show, and I appreciate you giving me a glimpse into your world and being nice enough to answer all of these questions. And if anybody has enjoyed listening to you on the show, how can they find you? How can they get a hold of you?
You know, tweeting at me at LSV is pretty much the easiest. I see all the times that people talk to me, and every now and then, like, I might miss something. So, you know, feel free to ping me again if you want, or you can email me, just lsv@channelfireball.com. So I also read all my email. So I'm not always the fastest to respond. I will put that out, you know, just so people know, but I do, there are definitely ways to get a hold of me if that's your desire.
Okay. Well, once again, LSV, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I look forward to running into you at a GP sometime in the near future or tuning in to see you in the coverage booth on a stream sometime.
No problem. It was a lot of fun, and let me know when it goes up so I can spread the word.
Absolutely. And if anybody here has enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review or some stars. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can keep up with me at Original Estrus, and you can also email me personally at estrus@elitistrix.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves. Okay? Bye.